With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
We made this.
Hello and welcome back everyone to a podcast all about the sounds of cinema and television and discussion about them between the notes, which is where we come in. I'm your host, Tony Black.
And I'm Sean Wilson.
And in this episode, we're back for part two of our best of 2021 scores and looking ahead to what we're most anticipating in 2022. We just did films 10 down to 6 in the last episode, talking about things as varied as The Green Knight through to The Beatles Get Back through to Promising Young Woman and quite a dose of Marvel along the way. But in this one, we're covering an equal variety as we talk about what we consider both of our top fives. So we're in the creme de la creme here, I think, Sean. So why don't you kick us off with what your number five entry would be?
So this is Don't Look Up by Nicholas Britell, whom we obviously referred to in the previous episode with his score for The Underground Railroad. Again, I think picking up on our thread from earlier, this confirms Britell as one of the most exciting and dynamic and versatile film composers of the modern age. I mean, this score for Don't Look Up is completely different from The Underground Railroad, as you would expect, because the subject matter is different, you know, the intention is different, but it just confirms how Britell can adapt to different idioms. So just to briefly recap, Netflix movie directed by Adam McKay, astonishing all-star cast led by Leonardo DiCaprio and Jennifer Lawrence, both of whom play astronomers who discover a meteor, and then they discover that the meteor's trajectory will set it on a collision course with Earth, and everyone is basically going to die. And the more they try and convince people that the end of days is coming, the less seriously they're taken. The irony being that, you know, the more you shout about a disaster in people's faces, the more they'll turn their backs on it. And, you know, it's not a great movie. It's glib, it's trite. It's basically an overextended Saturday Night Live sketch. I don't think it plumbs any great insights necessarily, but it is superficially amusing. It did make me laugh all the way through, albeit it made me laugh on a kind of broad cartoonish kind of level. I don't think the movie is it's never as dark or as insightful as it should be, is it, really? I don't what did you think of it?
Well, I mean, this has really ripped Twitter apart, hasn't it, in the last few days, like the last week or so, over the Christmas period. Like, there's been lots of discussion over whether this is rubbish or really great. And I liked it. I liked it more than I think some other people did. But I agree with your assessment. It is very glib. It is a bit smug. It is superficial. And for me, that was the point. I think the idea is that, you know, the cast are really good in this, particularly Jennifer Lawrence, who plays a character who literally at one point on the most facile chat show ever shouts into camera, "We're all gonna fucking die!" Like, and I think, and there's been a lot of talk about it being a big metaphor for climate change, and it is as subtle as a brick, but I think that's kind of the point. I mean, when you have the very broad targets that Meryl Streep, as a very Trumpian president, and her dumbass son, played by Jonah Hill, who's very clearly like, you know, Donald Trump Jr. or whatever, or Jared Kushner or these people, they are like, it's very clear who they're going after. And I think, you know, given what we've had in the last 5 years, I think satire in a way is really hard to do now, because so much of what would have been satirized has happened and is happening. So I think in a way, a broad targets aren't necessarily a bad thing. And I think Don't Look Up at least has the front to really scream in your face, "Wait, we've got to wake up. What are we doing? This is all bonkers." So, I mean, I think I described it to someone as like throwing Deep Impact, the 1988 asteroid movie, and the 1976 Sidney Lumet film Network into a blender. Yeah. Anyway, now, it's not as good as either of them, let me just preface that, but, you know, Network is famous for Peter Finch going, I'm mad as hell! You know, and it's just amazing. One of the best moments in cinema history, that is. But there is a little bit of that in Jennifer Lawrence and when Leonardo DiCaprio later on loses it on TV as well, which I appreciated. So I like the film, but Britell's score was fab. To get back to the music, wasn't it really good? Like, it was this really... I think it knew that the film was daft because it plays a very sort of silly, you know, over-the-top sort of jazzy register to what is actually quite a serious, in theory, is quite a serious topic, isn't it? The destruction of the world, all these, you know, ideas going through. But he plays it at a really heightened, fun register.
Yeah, there are basically two... There are two themes in it which occupy different idioms. You've mentioned the big, like, raucous, big band jazz swing there, which is essentially, that's the absurdist theme. That's the theme that underscores the incredulity of DiCaprio and Lawrence's characters. The fact that the more that they announce this, the more the situation becomes perverse and twisted. And there's something about using kind of raucous big jazz for that, which works on a kind of broad comic level. There's also the much more introverted and beautiful sort of string glockenspiel theme, which is about the imminent tragedy of the situation, about the fact that, you know, these two characters know that the world is going to end, but no one wants to listen to them. And the way Britell interweaves the increasingly as the score goes on, these two themes are interwoven within individual tracks together. So you get the idea of, you know, the jazz is inverted to sound melancholy, the melancholy is inverted to sound jazz-like and silly. And I think the idea is that good and bad, kind of sad and funny, all become interwoven throughout the score very, very well. There's also a superb track called The Launch, which is, again, this is a very ironic score. It uses sort of melodic beauty in a very ironic way, because The Launch underscores the entire mission as to what to do with this asteroid is appropriated by this hideous tech guru, played by Mark Rylance, who is just one of the most punchable villains
I've
seen.
Who speaks like this all the way through, doesn't he? He's like, he's got this kind of weird register that, oh yes, I'm going to change the world with my asteroid technology.
My favourite scene in the film is where he basically, Leonardo DiCaprio dares to suggest, right, are you approaching this as a scientist or as a businessman? He's like, did you just call me a businessman? He's like, you know, we've got 40 data points on you, and I know how you're going to die. And your death was so unremarkable and boring. But yeah, I know this about you. You're going to die alone. And it's he's horrible.
Really, it's awful, isn't it?
But he's among the many cartoonish pantomimic characters who skewered musically by Nicholas Britell in this score. But the movie pulls it together for a very, very poignant climax, and it's very, very well scored in the climax. It gets at the end of the day, the score is more sincere than it is sardonic. I think the score does aim to capture that sense of tragedy, and I think it does it actually very well, and it confirms Nicholas Britell as a really, really exciting composer to watch.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's really interesting. The fact the film has caused so much of a schism in people proves that it's worth seeing, I think, whatever side of the fence you're on. And the music just accompanies that in a brilliant way. So yeah, it's a really, really good choice. I'm glad you put it on here, actually, as a fairly sort of late entry, because it only came out Christmas Eve. So, you know. So for my number five, I've gone for the other Johnny Greenwood one we talked about in the previous part. This is The Power of the Dog, which was Jane Campion's adaptation of the book of the same name, came out at the start of December, starring Thimblework, Creeping Cratch.
or as Philomena Kunk calls him, a Benlin Thundercrack.
That's way better than mine. And Jesse Plemons, Kirsten Dunst, set in Montana in the 20s, sort of at the end, in a way, of the American West period. And it's about two brothers who own a farmhouse, and one falls in love with Kirsten Dunst's character, who comes in and changes the dynamic, particularly for Cumberbatch's character. And it's a really interesting film. It's a very measured and slow film in many ways. It looks beautiful. It's got a great script. It's got some really great performances. I mean, I think Cumberbatch is particularly excellent in this. And I thought Greenwood's music, I mean, very different from Spencer, because here he's playing much more on a melodic register. He taps a lot of the traditional sort of themes you hear in, because it's a bit like a Western, but it's much more of like a psychological drama in many ways, as opposed to being, you know, cowboys and Indians, you know, all that. It's not like that at all. It's just, it happens to be set in the American expanse, but it is much more of, it's a very sad story, really. It's quite a, it has the pretensions of being rough-edged, but it's actually very, very sensitive in the middle of it. And I think that's what Greenwood gets in his music. He manages to capture that wilderness and capture that sense of the frontier and that harshness. But at the same time, there is a lot of romance to this score, I think. And in that sense, parts of it reminded me of Phantom Thread, which we mentioned earlier as well, in a different way. And I think it's great how he can flip between these much more jagged-edged soundscapes. Like when you mentioned There Will Be Blood, there's a lot of that in there, but then he can also do this stuff at the same time. I think he's really varied, and I thought the film was great. It made my top 10 of the year, and the music's beautiful.
Yeah, it shows that Johnny Greenwood can get under the skin of characters brilliantly in musical form. I thought the film was, how do I describe it? The film was very, very Jane Campion. in as much as I found it largely inscrutable, quite sort of maybe kind of alienating and slightly emotionally distancing, despite the fact that I read the Thomas Savage book on which it's based, and I really liked the book, and I thought Cumberbatch was brilliant as Phil Burbank. He got his savagery but also his repressed sexuality very well. Like, the idea is, it is a story of repressed sexuality, like you say, it's a Western, but it's not a Western, and therefore Johnny Greenwood's score owes itself to Western conventions, you know, banjos, guitars and so on, yet it doesn't owe itself to that. There is a melodic sweep which suggests that it's not, you know, you can't define the story by the landscapes and by the appearance of the people. It's kind of more of an archetypal mythical Cain and Abel story to it, the idea of two brothers, you know, who are opposed and, you know, who are wildly opposed to each other. And I think Johnny Greenwood's score picks up on those psychological dimensions. I have to say, within the context of the movie, I found it relatively subtle, which I think was the point. I think I had to listen quite hard to actually pick it out. I mean, again, it might be the classic thing, because I wasn't emotionally engaged with the drama of the film, I might have found it a bit more of a challenge to connect emotionally with the music, which is something that is the weird dichotomy of film music. You know, can you engage with the music and not engage with the film? If you're not engaged with the film, does that mean that you're inherently not engaged with the music? For me, it vacillates from project to project. I mean, for me personally, Spencer was my favourite Johnny Greenwood score of the year. And as we mentioned on the, you know, on the previous podcast, he's also got Licorice Pizza, the new Paul Thomas Anderson movie. He's written the score for that, which again is completely different. Again, you know, very bittersweet and very gentle. Whatever one's thoughts on individual Johnny Greenwood scores, you can't deny that he's become a superb artiste. I mean, it's really exciting to watch him develop like this, don't you think?
Oh God, yeah. Yeah, really. Like, it's been very interesting to see how he's come on. And, you know, we talked a bit about it in the last episode with Spencer. But yeah, there's so many possibilities he can do, you know, so many possible kind of movies he could take on and projects. He is emerging, you know, as I mentioned about Nicholas Britell emerging as one of the modern greats. I think Johnny Greenwood is, actually. I think, and it's been happening for a good 10 years now, I think, slowly but surely. So, yeah, or more, in fact. So it's great. It is really good. And we're seeing a real diversity from him. So no, it's a great score, and I think your misgivings are fair. You know, I do there. I think it was quite emotionally distancing in many ways as a film. It's a slippery one, and I think that's why it's been so well regarded, because it doesn't give you everything on a plate. You know, and that's good. That's a good thing. That is a good thing in an emotional and literal way. So no, it's good. It's a good piece.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
Laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Your number four then, Sean, is a film I've done quite well, because quite often I'm like, oh, I've not seen that. This is the first one on the list so far. It's a film I haven't seen. I think it's the only one I haven't seen, actually, on this list. No, tell a lie. There is another one this episode. But yeah, why don't you tell us what your number four is then and why you love it?
So this is The Score for Minari by Emil Mosseri, who Mosseri is another very, very exciting rising star in the film score world. He scored the likes of The Last Black Man in San Francisco a couple of years ago,
which is
a very lovely score, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
And again, there's a very, very, he's got a very distinctive sound. He's only done a handful of movies, and there's a very, again, I hate to draw the comparison with Alexandre Desplat again, but I think this shows how influential Desplat is. There's a very crystalline quality to Mosseri's music, very crystalline, very metronomic, very precise, lots of use of chimes and glockenspiels and strings that have these sort of suspensions and sort of unexpected intervals. There's a very sort of delicate sense of, there was the Miranda July movie that he scored as well, the name of which escapes me.
Is that Cajillionaire?
Cajillionaire, that's it, Cajillionaire, yeah. Which again had a, you know, similarly like almost offbeat quality to it, although it was a Miranda July film, to be fair. I mean, Minari is a lovely story, Oscar-winning film from director Lee Isaac Chung about a Korean family living in America in the 1980s, who the father of whom decides to up sticks and move them to rural Arkansas so they can live off the land. And it's a very, very bucolic, very gentle, very well-observed movie. There's nothing mawkish or melodramatic about it, which means Mosseri is perfect to score this, because that very kind of shimmering, delicate sound that he's got to his music accentuates the emotion without ever swamping it. And it's just a really lovely, graceful, balletic, melodic score that captures the, you know, the various interactions between these different family members, all of whom have got different motivations, different aspirations, primarily Stephen Yeun as the father, who is, you know, desperate to make a go of it in the USA, you know, the land of opportunity. And, you know, there's a conflict between whether his young children are destined to speak Korean or speak English, and all these complex family dynamics that are just gently accentuated by Mosseri's music. And the Minari of the title is a plant that grows near where they're living. It's kind of it's a watercress, almost in a way, and apparently this is something that's used very, it's prevalent throughout Korean culture, particularly in cooking. And the idea is that they come across this plant in America, and it's kind of a reminder of their roots and then their family. And it's a really lovely film, and it's a really beautiful score. I mean, I was lucky enough to interview Emil Mosseri this year, and he's a really exciting talent to watch. Again, we've got, I mean, one of the things I must address is when people say about modern day film music, oh, you don't get any great film scores anymore. It's nonsense. I mean, with voices like Mosseri and Johnny Greenwood and Nicholas Britell, yeah, Anthony Willis and so on and so forth, you know, Daniel Hart, there are plenty of exciting voices out there at the moment. One just has to go and look for them.
Yeah, no, absolutely, yeah. And I think we're showcasing quite a few on this podcast, because they really are sort of sticking out. And I am really excited to see Minari. It's a film that's available now and I really want to watch, because the music was gorgeous. It was a lovely score. It was really, really emotive and sweet. And yeah, just I really like Mosseri, and he's done some really great stuff, and I really can't wait to see what he does in future. And he's, you know, he's plying his trade. He's not going into too many of these big movies and this kind of thing. He's, you know, he's plying his trade in some nice, more niche, you know, stuff. And I think that's great. And I am really excited to see what he does next. I really like that one. That's a really good choice. For My number four is also your number three, so I'm going to let you lead on this one, Sean. This was one we did a big episode. This is sort of the focus on. I don't think it was the last episode we did, but it was the episode before. Probably the biggest movie, really, of last year in many ways. Dune, Denis Villeneuve's Dune, and the score by Hans Zimmer. We talked at length about this. So is it a surprise that it's not made either of our number ones? Or maybe my number one, because you're not the greatest Zimmer fan always. Sometimes you love what he does, sometimes you don't. So maybe it's less of a surprise that it's not your number one, but is it a surprise that it's not mine? I don't know. What do you think? Has your opinion changed on this much in the last couple of months before we talked about this, Sean?
It's solidified somewhat. I think that it demonstrates, you know, that the best and worst of Zimmer, like the fact that he does have a very, very idiosyncratic voice. And I like the fact that, you know, there is very little orchestra used in this score. It's basically electronics and speciality instruments that create this appropriately hazy wash. It's like listening to the score is almost trying to sort of peer through the air of Arrakis and seeing the spice particles glimmering in the air. That's the best way I can describe listening to the score, is kind of an approximation of that. It's got this very interesting pan-Arabic tone to it, with the use of, you know, the duduk and various other instruments. Three credited vocalists, which as Villeneuve and Zimmer decided that, because basically the women are the characters who drive the Dune narrative, the Bene Gesserit and so on and so forth, the female vocals humanize the narrative and also implicitly suggest what's going on behind the scenes. I think that's a brilliant touch. I think it works very well. The vocals are alternately kind of melodic and gentle, and also very strident and often quite deliberately unpleasant in the way that it should be. There are whole sections in it where it does go down the noisy, aggressive, sort of industrially processed Hans Zimmer route, which I find harder to appreciate. It kind of reminds me of the lesser material from his Christopher Nolan collaborations, but I understand why they have to be there. I don't think the score is particularly innovative. This is why it's not my number one score of the year. I mean, it's not innovative. This basically is a hodgepodge of everything that Hans Zimmer has done before, from Driving Miss Daisy with its electronic experimentation through to Gladiator, again, which had the kind of pan-Arabic Middle Eastern tone to it in a lot of ways. I mean, this basically reconstitutes a lot of the things that Hans Zimmer has done before, but it works brilliantly in the film, and I think he gets the tone of Arrakis and the tone of the characters very, very well. It's not a game changer, and I'm not convinced that it's a masterpiece, but I am very excited to see what Zimmer is now going to do for Dune Part 2.
Just a point. When you mentioned the score for Driving Miss Daisy, did you actually mean the score for Bangkok Chick Boys?
Driving Miss Daisy, is it a good film? I couldn't see it because I was in the bathroom.
Well, you can if you angle the mirror. You know.
No, I only watched it for 5 minutes. We've gone on a bit of a Partridge tangent.
Yeah, sorry. This may not stay in the edit, but we'll see how playful I feel.
I think it needs to.
I think it might,
if we inspire
what,
people to go and watch Partridge.
Yeah, one for Partridge fans, Alan Partridge. Sorry, guys. But yes, I too agree that it will be really interesting to see what happens. I mean, I thought it was excellent, but I don't think it's necessarily his best work. It's not as good as he does get my number one spot for another movie that came out recently. I'm sure you can all guess which one that is. But yeah, I don't know how listenable it is, really, in many ways. You know, it works well for the movie. I don't know if it's as enjoyable independently. So I agree with what you've said, but I will be very interested to see where he takes this, because it is like a sort of high scale, and in many ways, in this modern day and age, as big as film scoring can get in some ways. So, you know, it'll be very interesting to see what he does for part two, which we now know definitely is coming down the pipe. So, yeah, looking forward to that.
The other thing I just wanted to say briefly was that he actually did three albums for this. And in many ways,
yeah,
I preferred the Sketchbook album, which was basically the initial impressions.
Same.
Before it was finally mixed down into the mix that we hear in the film, that the Sketchbook were the initial like previs musical ideas, and in many ways I prefer that, because a lot of that, I mean, some of it is much more violently discordant than what's heard in the film. A lot of it is actually more melodic and it's more clearly thematic. And I think it's interesting that probably Denis Villeneuve didn't really want themes in the score. There are impressions, there are motifs, largely from the vocals. Again, whether this is symptomatic of a problem in modern day film music that, you know, largely arises from directors and producers who don't want themes in music. They just want, you know, they want the suggestions of themes. Obviously, that's open for debate. I mean, I've got very, very mixed feelings on that. But yeah, I think Dune, you know, solidifies Hans Zimmer's position as a very, very idiosyncratic composer in his own right.
Yeah, 100%. No, I completely agree with that. Yeah. So for my number three, I've gone for The French Dispatch by Alexandre Desplat, which we talked about, I think, in the last episode. Obviously, you know, Wes Anderson movie, colourful, a completely unlike anything else you really are going to see. We talked about it before. I didn't love the film. I feel like I might enjoy it on a second watch a bit more. I found it a bit too Wes Anderson on steroids, this one, a little bit. But the music, I thought, was lovely. I really did. I thought particularly the, because it's in three sections, essentially, the film, three vignettes. And the third one, which revolves around Jeffrey Wright's character, particularly, has this brilliant section which is involving a chase with police, and it is that classic sort of dun 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 dun.
I love that bit. That was my favourite bit in the film. I thought that was really funny.
it was really good. Yeah, that was probably my favourite sequence, actually. Yeah, definitely. And I think, and the music to that is fab. It's just this continuous, like, three or four tracks that just builds and builds and builds and builds this. And it's got that very metronomic style to it that Desplat does. And, you know, this is a very good compliment score to the Grand Budapest Hotel. And I would argue, really, that The French Dispatch is a compliment to that film anyway. They are, you could double bill them, and I think it would work in many ways. But I think this is the lesser output in terms of score and film, actually. However, it really did stand out to me as one of my favourite bits of music of the year. Didn't make your top 10, though, Sean. So what do you make of this, just as a reprise?
As both a score and a film, I was very mixed on this. I'm a huge fan of Alexandre Desplat. I've learned to be a fan of Wes Anderson. Again, I love the Grand Budapest Hotel, and obviously that score by Desplat won an Oscar, and I thought that was a lovely mixture of balalaika and cimbalom, lovely Eastern European tone in that. The French Dispatch score starts brilliantly with what is essentially an overture track, which is called Obituary. Which is brilliant. I mean, it does that thing of each instrumentalist is kind of introduced one after the other. So, you know, the piano, the tubas, the clarinets, the flutes, the strings, and then they all steadily amalgamate together to perform this very, very celebratory impression of Bill Murray's newspaper editor. He's the one who establishes, American expat journalist in France, who establishes the eponymous French Dispatch newspaper. And, you know, the idea is that he's died. And the music celebrates his spirit in a very, very... I mean, it's obviously got a very appropriately provincial kind of Gaelic quality to it, which one would expect. But I think that track is wonderful. I think, unfortunately, after that, there's a lot of repetition in the score, which I think is to its detriment. I think a lot of ideas are stated, then reinstated again, and they aren't developed, which in a way which surprises me, because that's not normally a problem with Desplat. I love the sort of slinky, like, lounge jazz piano theme for Léa Seydoux's Prison Warden, which is in the first bit. That's got a kind of sultry, kind of suggestive quality to it. But I think by the time you get to the final part, which we've cited, which has got these repetitive, like, euphonium tuba interludes, like, okay, it's quite amusing the first time around, but I'm literally just hearing the same thing ever so slightly rearranged again and again and again. This is not a problem that I had with the Grand Budapest Hotel, which I think felt very fresh and very vital throughout it. So I don't know if it's a sign of a collaboration that's kind of running on fumes a little bit. Certainly I thought that with the film. I thought the film was... I was quite lukewarm on the film. A lot of it didn't work. Some bits of it were amusing. I mean, a lot of it just has that slightly airless, impenetrable feel that a lot of early Wes Anderson films had for me. So I wasn't won over by this one, I have to say.
No, I'm with you. I agree. Yeah, I felt the same about the film, really. But yeah, I did enjoy the score. But no, I can see where your issues are, definitely. And I think if I don't know if they'd be able to repeat this trick again in the same way, but we'll see what happens, really. But I'm very curious about your number two. Now, this is another the only other film I haven't seen yet. A film which has been...
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
God, not really very well received, I don't think, particularly. But and by a composer who doesn't often make top 10 lists, and even though he's been around for a while. Let's hear what you have to say about your number two, Sean. What is it? And what is it? Why is it this high up?
Yeah, so I've selected Ghostbusters Afterlife, which is composed by Rob Simonson. And in the previous episode, we mentioned Joel P. West making that shift from independent dramas to big budget blockbusters, in his case, Shang-Chi. And Rob Simonson is a composer who's very often dealt in kind of very critically acclaimed drama. You think of things like Foxcatcher or The Way, Way Back, and he's now graduated into this, you know, big, big franchise property that obviously, you know, deals with the, you know, the very, very sort of deeply entrenched legacy of Ghostbusters, and obviously this tripped up Paul Feig massively in 2016 with his reboot. And the idea with this one is that, right, okay, does Ghostbusters Afterlife, which is helmed by Jason Reitman, the son of Ivan Reitman, who made the first two Ghostbusters movies, does this film actually do anything dramatically interesting with the Ghostbusters legacy, or is it just lazy fan service? This is an argument that's raging across so many films at the moment. I think for the most part, I liked Ghostbusters Afterlife. I mean, there is a lot of pandering to the fans, but I think when you get down to the score, it's a really fascinating hybrid of Elmer Bernstein's original 1984 melodies, which were, I think, overlooked in their initial iteration. I mean, clearly the Ray Parker Jr. song is what people tend to think of when they think of Ghostbusters, unsurprisingly. But Rob Simonson appropriates those original Elmer Bernstein melodies and really breathes new life into them. He turns, for example, that original jazz tack piano theme for the Ghostbusters themselves in the 84, when he now turns it, he builds into a big adventurous theme. He deconstructs it, he puts fragments of it all over the place. So arguably he has thrown more emphasis onto the original Elmer Bernstein themes than was evident in the original 1984 film. And because legacy and nostalgia is key to this film, some would say to the film's detriment. I think as in terms of the score, it's a fascinating example of past and present, of Bernstein's personality and Simonson's personality being in it all at once. I thought it was a really, really impressive piece of work. And it's very easy to say, well, all that Simonson is doing is quoting Bernstein. It's like, yeah, but the ways in which he quotes him, the way in which he suggests impressions of that 1984 score with just a few notes or a few chords, and then builds into like a big thunderous organ choral passage, and then brings it back to the Bernstein score, and then veers off again in a completely different direction. It's incredibly harmonious and fluid the way he does it. It's not a scattershot thing. It's very, very well considered and very well thought through, and it does embody the sense that, as in the film, you're dealing with a legacy. You're dealing with the legacy of a particular character. I won't say who it is, but and therefore it makes sense that the score takes on this form. I thought this was a really great score. It reminded me so much of the 1980s scores that I used to love from John Williams and Jerry Goldsmith and Bernstein himself, James Horner, Alan Silvestri, and so on. Very, very rich orchestral colours, you know, melodies, great action material. I loved it to bits. I thought it was great.
Yeah, I liked it, I have to say. And obviously, I haven't seen the film yet, and I will eventually. But yeah, I enjoyed it. I definitely see what you say about the comparisons and the links to the original. You can tell that Simonson has definitely, you know, tried to dip back into that well a little bit. But no, I enjoyed it. I did enjoy it broadly. I thought it was good. I thought it could be one of those better scores than the movies kind of examples, maybe. But I will wait and see what I think of the film. But I'm excited. I'm more excited to see it now, I think, having heard you talk about it in that way, actually. So yeah, once it hits the streamings, I will check it out. Definitely.
don't cross the streamings.
Don't cross the stream. Exactly, yeah. So, yeah, we're on to the top two now. So my number two is also your number one. So why don't you lead on this? Because I think we both love this score in a big way. So we have gone for, as my number two and your number one, we've gone for Spider-Man No Way Home by Michael Giacchino. Your favourite score of 2021, my second favourite. So yeah, Sean, take it away. Why is this the best score for you of 2021?
I mean, wow, I mean, there's so much to say about this, isn't there? I mean, firstly, let me say that I love Michael Giacchino's music in general. I love the way that he's picked up the baton of those, you know, those masters, like, I've just cited them, Jerry Goldsmith, John Williams, Alan Silvestri, James Horner, the way that he is the modern incarnation of those guys, in as much as he puts theme and melody first. He's clearly, you know, one of the big blockbuster musical practitioners of the moment. And there's a reason for that, which is that, you know, I interviewed Michael Giacchino a few years ago now, and he basically, you know, he, with every score that he does, he is saluting those masters, those composers, Goldsmith, Williams and so on. Those are the composers with whom he grew up listening to. And he is now in a position of being able to parlay that love and that influence into scores like Spider-Man No Way Home. So this is obviously the third of his Spider-Man scores following Far From Home and Homecoming. And he's done other scores in the Marvel Cinematic Universe like Doctor Strange. And I think that, you know, Michael Giacchino, like Alan Silvestri, is one of the composers who's really brought a thematic sense to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, because it was very, very faltering up to quite recently. The idea is, okay, are there any memorable themes in the Marvel Cinematic Universe? Well, yes, but I think it's a relatively recent thing within the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and it owes itself to composers like Silvestri and Giacchino. And clearly, with this being not only the third musical installment of this particular Spider-Man trilogy, but it obviously also owing itself to the multiverse, which allows other musical themes to be imported into it. So, for example, you know, Danny Elfman's Green Goblin theme from 2002 Spider-Man, Danny Elfman's Dr. Octopus theme from 2004 Spider-Man 2, you know, loads and loads of other themes are then grafted onto Giacchino's own material, which he has established via Far From Home and Homecoming. So you do have the main Spider-Man theme, you have the Doctor Strange theme, which is appropriately enough quoted regularly throughout. And I just think it's a masterclass in thematic scoring, in the way there are lots of disparate elements, lots of, you know, there are legacy themes that are deployed in this. There are also Giacchino's own themes, the way they're all, you know, like when Doctor Strange does his spell and he moves his hands through the air and he kind of creates these incredible like whirls of like magic and spells. I imagine Giacchino sort of doing that musically, like sort of plucking all of these different things and arranging them in this kind of, you know, in this remarkable impressionistic tapestry. And I know that a lot of people have taken aim at this score for, you know, apparently, you know, maybe not deploying the legacy themes as much as perhaps one might expect. I like how it's done. That, you know, for example, the Green Goblin and Dr. Octopus themes are done quite tastefully. They're done very strategically, maybe only a few bars in a certain point. But that makes sense, because it's a score for Tom Holland, the Spider-Man. It's his destiny. And the way that his Spider-Man theme is deconstructed from like a heroic sense to a sort of more emotional, heart-rending sense at one point. And then there's another theme which Giacchino brings in, which I suppose it could be given any number of names, really. I like to call it the redemption theme, the idea that in this Spider-Man film, his Peter Parker actually grows up. You know, he suffers a vicious betrayal. And there's another theme that Giacchino introduces, which is probably, you know, you could also call it the great responsibility theme, which does build alongside all of these myriad other musical ideas in it. And I think it all feels very coherent. It's very Giacchino. I mean, I love the action music in it. The action music is, don't you think it's got that very Danny Elfman? So, I mean, I think this is doffing the cap to Danny Elfman, the use of the timpani to create almost this carnivalesque sense of just excitement and chaos going on. I mean, that's got to have been deliberate. I mean, I'm pretty sure it was deliberate, don't you think?
Yeah, definitely. I think the whole thing's just a ride. Like, I really do. I think it's an absolute, a carnival-esque kind of atmosphere at parts of it. He's definitely true. And then he contrasts that with the sequence where, spoilers, in case you haven't seen the film, but, you know, just warning you, spoilers, where Aunt May dies, you have that, you have a beautifully sad elegy to that as well,
yeah,
in one track. And you know, so he does both in this film. I thought it was really brilliant, like, in terms of the complexity. You know, I mean, it's hard to say that Giacchino, this is Giacchino at the top of his game. I think Giacchino has been at the top of his game for getting on for about 15 years now, frankly. I think he's just consistently brilliant in what he does. He very rarely puts a foot wrong. He is, for me, the greatest current living composer outside of the, you know, John Williams and any of the long-term greats who are still with us. I think he's fantastic. And I think this is the kind of example of that, where he's pulling from all these different areas, like you've said, you know, you've described really well. And he's making it work in a film that, you know, I mean, I really enjoyed this film. I thought it was great. And I think a lot of people haven't felt that. They felt it was messy and noisy and a bit chaotic. And I get that completely, because I think it is. I think it knows it is, in a way, this film. I think that's kind of the point, really. The score could have been a mess. It could have been an absolute mess, but it's not. It's amazingly, I mean, it's more skilled in terms of how it's organised and put together than probably the film is, realistically.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the film is a bit wibbly and wobbly, and it goes all over the place. But, you know, I think it really, really helps sell the emotion I felt emotion in this film. I did. You know, and I'm not even the greatest Spider-Man fan in the world. I like them, you know, but I really felt it towards the end, you know, when you've got all of these different things going on, all these different Spider-Men going on, all these kind of things. Oh, you know, things that pay off, certain payoffs that have been people have been waiting for a long time. You know, I felt it. And I think the music, 100%, the skill of this music helps sell that in this film for me. And that's why I agree with you. It's Marvel's best score this year. And, you know, I'm going to go as far as to say this is my favourite Giacchino score for the Spider-Man trilogy. Personally.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, one can feel his affection for the Spider-Man character. And again, when people say, oh, there are no great film scores anymore, you know, when people sort of watch Indiana Jones and listen to John Williams' music, people say, oh, you know, I pine for this kind of orchestral music. Where is it? Giacchino is doing it.
Yeah, this, totally.
He's carrying the mantle for
100%.
It. And when, you know, when he deploys the choir, you know, in the Arachne Overture, at the final track, it's just sensational. And it is a celebration of the Spider-Man legacy, particularly when the vocals are involved. It hits new heights, and it's superb. Yeah, my favourite score of the year, easily.
I totally get it. It would have been mine were it not for a certain debonair secret agent who also came back this year. Because my number one is inevitably No Time to Die. Now, I watched this on Christmas Day with my in-laws. And with my wife for the second time, she'd seen it. So it was my third time. And I actually, this film is, it actually, I think, is becoming one of those Bond films that I like more the more I see it, actually. And I really liked it first time around, but I really think it's, as it's settling, I'm starting to really, really like it even more. And the music, I just think this is one of Hans Zimmer's best scores. I really do. Like, I think there is, and we talked a lot about it, I think, in our last episode, you know, when we did a lot about Bond. But this is just brilliant, I think. You know, there are certain sequences in this that just blow me away in terms of the music. You know, the opening Materia sequence, the Cuba chase thing, one which I think we both sort of said was probably the best on the album before, which is just this thrilling, you know, Bondian ride. The way he has this recurring building theme in there, the dun 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 dun, it builds in three different sections throughout the film, right at the beginning, in the middle, and then at the end, in different tonal, you know, compositions. I just love what he does in this. I really do. And I'm listening to it again, and listening to this score, I listened to more than any other score last year. I had it on repeat rotation around October, November time. And this isn't even getting into how he works John Barry's All the Time in the World in there, which I know has been a bit controversial, and some people have suggested it doesn't work, or, you know, it's a bit... And, you know, that whole scene where Bond is talking to M and then they drip in the Majesty's sort of theme is a bit odd. It is a bit odd. But I think he manages to bring that in really well. We talked at length about this before, so I won't go into too much detail, but I still think this has been my favourite score of the year, and I still think it's really rich. I think it deserves to be up there with some of the best Bond movie scores for me.
Yeah, I think it's an impressive score. I'm really, really glad that you've picked it. I mean, it's lovely to see, you know, a musical representation of the Bond franchise coming out on top of your list of the best scores of the year. For me, I think there's a battle going on in it between the Zimmer mannerisms and the Bond mannerisms. And I think you astutely pointed out a couple of them there, particularly the use of the, you know, the weird use of the On Her Majesty's Secret Service main theme during that conversation with Bond and M, which doesn't make any sense dramatically at all. Although it's kind of subtly there in the background. I don't know why that is in there necessarily, although the use of We Have All the Time in the World, it works emotionally, if not chronologically. So you think, hang on a minute, because that was composed for a completely different Bond actor in a completely different era. Why are we now hearing it here? But then, you know, continuity has never been to the forefront in the Bond franchise in any sense, you know, musically, dramatically, narratively. So I'll forgive it that. I think that there is an issue between that very, very aggressive Hans Zimmer, Christopher Nolan sound and maybe the more organic symphonic expectations of what one would expect the Bond score to sound like. Although I have to say, Bond scores have always mutated and changed, and there isn't, you know, John Barry is the musical backbone of this series, but then if you think of what David Arnold did in terms of picking up that sense of orchestral melody and then infusing those, you know, synth samples and electronic sounds into it, David Arnold was doing that as well. So it might seem churlish of me to criticise Hans Zimmer for that. But with Zimmer, it's not the instrumentation or the electronics that's the problem. It's the tone, you know, because Hans Zimmer has got such an overbearing tone to his action music that I think that in the No Time to Die soundtrack tends to swamp, you know, the Bond stuff. Not always. I mean, you know, we did cite the Cuba chase bit, which is brilliant. I mean, that's the most quick-witted and humorous and kind of ironic track on the album. I think that's what's needed. I think that more of that, you know, very often when John Barry scored James Bond, he said it was multi-million dollar Mickey Mouse music. That's how he described it. And John Barry was, you know, fairly disparaging of the later Bond movies that he scored, and one could sense that he was becoming less and less interested in it. I think the problem is that I have with Hans Zimmer's No Time to Die is that a lot of it is overly portentous in a way that doesn't mesh with my expectations of Bond, particularly towards the end, towards the final sequence on the island with Rami Malek's character. So that is a problem. That said, there are themes in it, and I love thematic scores. The way he uses Billie Eilish's main title melody is superb, really, really great, and it does create a sense of vulnerability and empathy for Daniel Craig's Bond, so that kind of swings the needle the other way. I will applaud the score for that. So I think for me it's a mixed bag. I think June, for me as a soundtrack, June is a more successful Hans Zimmer experiment, but I think there are very, very admirable things in No Time to Die. But I'm delighted that you've picked it, because it allows us to talk about Bond and the history of Bond music, which is great.
Yeah. We went really in depth on that in the last episode. So, you know, I'd refer anyone back to that, because that was a great chat. And yeah, I think No Time to Die was my number three top movie of 2021. So Bond's always got to be in there, you know, in the mix for me, because I'm, you know, that's just what I like. But this has been great. These are our top 10 then, each of scores. I think we've got some real musical jewels over these last two episodes. So it's been, there's been some fantastic listening going on over the last week or so, and over the last year, to be fair. So we will put together the usual Spotify playlist of examples for people to go and listen to, and you're in for a treat. You're in for an absolute treat there. But before we go, let's briefly talk about what we're looking forward to for the rest of this year then. So what is standing out for you, Sean, in terms of films and the scores for particular films that you're excited to see come in?
Well, we've got a lot of big franchise properties this year. We've got a lot of big comic book movies in particular. So I'm really looking forward to Danny Elfman reuniting with Sam Raimi for Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. Really, really excited about that, because the last comic book score they did was 2004 Spider-Man 2, which is obviously, as we said, was cited in Michael Giacchino's score for Spider-Man No Way Home. I mean, Spider-Man 2 led to a falling out between the two of them, which then led to Christopher Young scoring some of Spider-Man 2 and then all of Spider-Man 3. So I'm really, really excited to see what the two of them are going to do for the Doctor Strange sequel. I'm really interested to see what James Newton Howard is going to do for Fantastic Beasts, The Secrets of Dumbledore. It's not a franchise in which I'm emotionally invested, but I do like what James Newton Howard has done with it musically. And in fact, I should point out James Newton Howard's Jungle Cruise was that close to getting into my top 10 of 2021. It was so close.
That's very good. Yeah. I was a bit surprised when you didn't put that in, actually. I thought you might put that in there. Yeah.
It was very, very close. If I could do a top 11, but then that's kind of breaking the rules.
Yeah.
So there's a couple of examples of what I'm looking forward to.
They're great. They're on my list as well. Things that stood out. I am really, really excited to see what Michael Giacchino is going to do with the Batman in a couple of months' time, because that could be thrilling stuff. And it will be really different from what Hans Zimmer and James Newton Howard did with the Nolan films. And I'm stoked for Lorne Balfe's Mission Impossible 7 as well, because I absolutely loved Fallout and his music for that. So I'm personally really excited to see how he's going to carry that through and do some more with that as well. Equally, towards the end of the year, I think a lot of people will be feeling this. Ludwig Göransson's Black Panther Wakanda Forever score, given how great an Oscar winning his first one was, I'm really, really excited to see if that's going to be as good this time round. I mean, that film is a big question mark generally, I think, in so many ways now. But given how great that first score was, bring that on, 100%. So there's lots of really interesting stuff, I think, coming this year. And hopefully, you know, we'll have more of a full normal year for 2022 and film releases, which means, and this isn't even counting potential TV stuff that we might talk about as well, but hopefully we'll be able to be back a little bit more regularly, monthly, you know, talking about stuff that's been going on, because we'll have films to see. So that'd be good this year.
Yeah, definitely. Well, there's a couple of other examples I just wanted to cite. Nathan Johnson's score for Nightmare Alley, which, as we record this, is coming out in just a few weeks.
It's coming soon. Yeah.
Coming soon. He replaced Alexandre Desplat on that, but then Desplat is scoring Del Toro's iteration of Pinocchio, which I believe is coming out towards the end of 2022. I might be mistaken about that. Two Guillermo del Toro films within the space of a year. And two Guillermo del Toro film scores within the space of a year, which should be exciting, to say the least.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. I reckon we'll cover Nightmare Alley fairly soon on the podcast, actually. That sounds like maybe one for next episode, possibly. We'll have to have a look at it and see. But yeah, there's some really cool stuff. So we're gonna hopefully be back a little bit more regularly to talk about that this year, fingers crossed. So yeah, the omens are good. Well, thanks, Sean. It's been great to chat, as always, with you about this stuff. So until we're back next time, do you want to remind people where they can find you online for a bit more, Sean?
So you can find me on Instagram at SeanFilmWriter and on Twitter at Sean022, where I'll be sharing more details about my upcoming book, The Sound of Cinema, which is due to be published by McFarlane Publishers at some point in 2022.
Do we have a date yet?
We don't have a date yet. We do have a front cover, which I have shared on Instagram and Twitter, so people can seek that out, because I'm excited about that.
yeah, I can't wait to read it. Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, that's coming down the pipe. That's going to be brilliant. You can find me on Twitter at AJBlackWriter and my website, AJBlackWriter.com, for any writing I'm doing as well. So look me up there. And more generally, the We Made This Podcast Network at WMT_network. But thanks for joining us for this episode. Please subscribe to Between the Notes and give us a 5-star rating review on Apple Podcasts. A review on Apple would be a nice late Christmas present for us, seriously, because it would really help us. So that'd be brilliant. If you want to help the network out, that We Made This Network, a little bit more, please check us out on Patreon. If you go to patreon.com/WeMadeThis for some bonus things, and just to give us we only ask for a very, very little small bit of money just to help us out, keep the network going. So huge thanks if you choose to do that. But the scores of 2021 are not all we're talking about on the network. So we'll give you a taste of what you might have missed in just a moment. But until next time, we hope you enjoy the film music. Check out the Spotify playlist that we'll have. Stay safe and well, and we'll see you next time discussing the music of film and maybe a bit of television between the notes.
Elsewhere on We Made This.
Read and buried.
I think that with this podcast, we get to explore all the different types of things that exist within crime.
Yes.
And the genre, the only rule being it has to be in a book.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The literary equivalent of fast food, and I love fast food.
Well, there you go, exactly.
And yeah, it's kind of a crime within a crime and a book within a book.
A murder. Oh.
Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast.
And I think what it actually does is simple, silly, short and on brand and fits Red Dwarf. But critically, because it is an advert, it's actually effective. I got the message that it is a better idea to use the app technology over a phone call to the AA. And that's surely the job done, right?
Yeah.
I didn't think it was like roll on the floor funny, but I didn't think it was unfunny. I thought Chris Barry's performance of he was ringing, it reminded me a lot of the old bank adverts you used to get where someone would be like, oh, you're with that new bank. Well, I'm with so-and-so bank and I can ring. I'm sure that there were adverts like Brian Laurie that used to do that back in the day, or Harry Enfield.
The Barclaycard adverts with Johnny England.
That's it.
Yes.
Movieversaries.
How old were you when you sort of came across Mulholland Drive? You've been pretty young, I would have thought.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that I watched it 2 days ago, but I haven't seen it since I was about 17 or 18.
Mm.
And I think the only reason I got into that is because I was a little film snob, but also because of the band Rammstein.
Right, they had, was it the song Rammstein in Lost Highway?
The song Rammstein was in Lost Highway, correct? But they also did a music video for some song, I can't remember what it was, but it was like a burning of a car. And I remember that I watched the making of and they just kept talking about it being Lynchian. And I was like, what does that mean?
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network. Between the Notes is produced and edited by Tony Black, who hosts alongside Sean Wilson. You can find Tony on Twitter at AJBlackWriter and Sean on Twitter at Sean022. You can find Between the Notes on Twitter at BTW_notes, on iTunes, your podcast app of choice, on Spotify, Stitcher and on Spreaker, where the show is part of the We Made This podcast network. For more podcasts all about TV, film, books, music and popular culture in general, you can find We Made This on Facebook and on Twitter at We Made This Pod. Thanks for listening.